lot going on this week in music. It's like I'm trying to listen to these music, these albums, but there's a very strong nostalgic pull that's telling me I need to listen to some other stuff.
This afternoon, I was going to go back through the albums again, even though I'd already formed a very, very firm opinion about one of them. So I got lost in a playlist, and then I came home and I was going to do that. And so I said to Sana, "Do you know who Chris Cornell is?" And she's like, "No." I was like, "Do you know who Soundgarden is?"
Chris Cornell? Did he come over and play for Internazionale di Milano?
And then I was like, oh, okay, so but you know who Rage
Chris
Against
Cornell. Chris Cornell. He's a Valentino Rossi's chief mechanic back in 1993.
Trying to explain Audioslave, and I'm like, oh, but you know who Rage Against the Machine is? And she's like, no. I was like, oh my God. So yes,
but why would you?
I guess she's 25. So
yeah, but she's in another country that doesn't speak English. They have a different language over there, which means they have different music.
But she knew who Nirvana was, and she could name Nirvana songs. So anyway, she didn't know what grunge meant.
Grunge. I don't know what the Italian translation.
Yes. So yes, that was I disappeared down that rat hole. I even played a bit of Pearl Jam today. So trying to provide some context.
Well, that was a bit dark. Someone tweeted, you know, this, you know, Kurt's gone and Chris Cornell's gone, and Scott Whitefield's gone, and they named some other grunge people gone. And Eddie Vedder's still alive. We have to make sure Eddie Vedder's. How is Eddie Vedder has to keep living? And then someone else tweeted, "Who do you think's killing them all?" Which was so bleak.
So
it's so funny.
It was interesting actually, just sort of quickly running through. Like Pearl Jam really is the soft rock of the grunge movement.
It became the soft rock of the grunge movement, really.
Yeah, quick. But even 10, like if you listen to Super Unknown and 10 back to back, like one's got a much bigger dynamic range, I believe.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I mean, Versus has got some teeth to it, but they yielded, thanks very much, into soft rock much quicker.
Are you making dad jokes, mate?
No, but that was literally it. I mean, No Code had a bit of snarl to it, but then Yield, which was kind of 97, 98, wasn't it? That was the move into, you know, middle of the road classic rock by comparison to what they're, and you know, you get, and then Pearl Jam, I kind of see as the control group for grunge bands. The rest of them flamed out sometimes literally and mortally, but others just in terms of band dynamics and all that sort of stuff. But Pearl Jam with a control group. What would happen if these guys just got old? And what you get is...
Yeah. Well,
kind of
Pearl Jam,
what happens with old people when they get old? They get more conservative, they get more boring, and they're not interesting anymore.
A little bit like AC/DC. Pearl Jam turned into a business, you know?
True, although AC/DC never changed their sound.
No. But like Pearl Jam obviously still enjoyed touring and playing and still wanted to release new stuff. So... You know,
and they did it in a very unique kind of way. I mean, they were the first band to do that. We're going to release every fucking live set we do. We're going to master it and make it available to you the day after. And other bands have done that since. Much more commercial bands, like I would say Metallica, are a much more commercially focused band than Pearl Jam were, at least. I mean, you never see Metallica releasing an album called No Code being a fucking diatribe against commercialism and you know, embracing the fucking the philosophy of Noam Chomsky or whatever the fuck it was about. I can barely remember that album, but I know there was a lot of jizz about it. Like all albums of the 90s, of that particular period of the 90s, I remember all the fucking media journalism bullshit that went alongside them. I can't remember the albums at all. It's pretty much how I felt about OK Computer the other week. It's like, I know all the shit that went on making this album. Like, Be Here Now is a perfect example of that Oasis album. I can tell you all about the fucking disasters that befell them when they were making the album. most of the songs I couldn't tell you about.
Well, that'd be a really interesting thing to see. What great band of the late 80s, early 90s made a good late 90s album? Because there was Chili Peppers, isn't there?
There's such a fault line in that kind of... And then this is, and it's not just because we were adolescents becoming, you know, teenagers in that spot. There is such a fault line in that early 90s period with the advent of grunge and the skate punk and dance music changed completely and all that and Britpop. There's so much different stuff that happened in that early 90s juncture point that bands that were big in the late 80s, I mean, like INXS, massive in the late 80s, their album from 1997, nobody cared about. And that was why people thought Hutchins had offed himself, when in reality he'd done himself a mischief trying to have a wriggle.
It's very euphemistic of you, Doc. I just think, like, you know, the Chili Peppers fell off a bit of a cliff. Some would argue Radiohead fell off a bit of a cliff. Pearl Jam fell off a bit of a cliff.
Whatever you say about OK Computer, and I said a lot about OK Computer, you couldn't say that they fell off a cliff in 1998. 1997. Their cliff falling off moment in terms of public regard was quite a bit beyond that.
Later. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it was with a year with a two in front of it.
Yeah.
But Radiohead didn't exist in the 80s. So your point remains. I mean, AC/DC, I'm just thinking of a band, released Ball Breaker in 96 and Stiff Upper Lip, I think, in 2001. Yeah. Those were perfectly serviceable albums, but you'd never call them up there with fucking Highway to Hell and Back in Black and TNT or anything like that. You'd never mistake them for being great.
Yeah. Anyway, should we talk about the someone new will albums? Write us in.
Yes, we should talk about the new albums, and then we'll get into the old man rock that will eventually dominate the rest of the conversation. So the new albums we picked this week, were for In Honor of New Zealand Music Month, which it is this May. Insert thing into Rayo that I said 2 weeks ago that I probably couldn't pull off again. A bunch of snotty punks called Dad Jokes and a bunch of old white guys, or kind of a Wellington supergroup called Teeth. Where would you like to start, Mr. Beasley?
Well, I can start very briefly with Dad Jokes.
You're going to start with Dad Jokes because you hate Dad Jokes because you don't understand how punk rock works.
Sure. Okay. That's it. Good. I'm glad you just did my review for me.
I knew you were
going to
hate this album because you're a cretin.
I hated this album.
Yeah, of course you did.
This is terrible. Terrible fucking... This is a terrible album.
Was that you dropping the mic? Because you should pick it back up again.
Yeah.
No. So I enjoyed this album because I'm not a cretin. I enjoyed the Van Halen cover. They didn't cover Van Halen. The cover is literally Van Halen, which is kind of cool. It's snotty lo-fi punk rock. If you smash the Ramones into the White Stripes, you'd probably get this.
Is it good snotty punk rock?
Snotty punk rock isn't meant to be good. It's what it is.
Like, is it a good example of the art, I guess, is what I'm saying.
No art. It's snotty punk rock. The point is that it's lo-fi. The point is that you and I should be able to do it. The point is that it's accessible. The point is that it is deliberately fucked. That's the point of snotty lo-fi punk rock.
Yeah. It's not the music for me.
No, it's not.
I wrote that
22 minutes isn't going to be long enough for Bezo to get properly irritated with it. But apparently it is.
I was irritated about 30 seconds.
I knew you were
going
to be irritated.
Oh, man. I did listen to the whole thing, though, and afterwards I was like...
Which song was better, the song about Arnold Schwarzenegger or the song about Jean-Claude Van Damme?
I can't tell you anything
exactly
about the album.
You didn't fucking listen to it at all, did you?
It just fucking, it was a grind, and at the end of it, I was like, oh, I'm so glad that's over.
Couldn't spare 22 minutes to listen to something outside his comfort zone, folks. This is the music expert you've paired me up with in and out.
What? No one ever claimed me to be a music expert. That's for fucking sure.
I do like the fact that when I saw Commando in the track list, I thought, oh, fuck, yeah, cool, it'll be a Ramones cover. No, it was literally a song about Commando, the movie. It's a song about, I'm a commando, going to rescue Alyssa Milano, which at that point, you've got me. I mean, any fucking song that's basically about the protagonist is Arnold Schwarzenegger from Commando, I'm in on. My favourite track on the album is actually the Jean-Claude Van Damme song. So, although Existential Dread is my jam, it speaks to me. It tells a lot of stories about me. So
tell me about
Teeth.
That
was always going to be a waste of fucking time, but we'll keep doing this until you learn. Teeth are actually they were described by The Spin-Off, which is kind of like I won't say a New Zealand Grantland because they don't do run about sport that much. They're kind of a
pop culture.
No, but they run a lot about politics and as well as pop culture and stuff. But describe them as brain frying pan generational Wellington supergroup, Teeth. So they're two parts Phoenix Foundation, who are a relatively long standing indie band from Wellington. One part, the Mutton Birds, who are a band that goes right back to the 80s. And then the guitarist from the Mutton Birds has since been writing music scores for Peter Jackson. And one part, kind of local session drum superhero fucking guy who's the greatest drummer in Wellington. So they've kind of fused all these. So imagine the Mutton Birds and the drum legend are the old dudes on that black and white cover of four white guys, which is... In its own way, as New Zealand is as you can get, they describe themselves as easy listening noise. I don't know what easy listening noise is. I guess this is easy listening noise.
The easy listenings, like I would have just called it. I don't know, like in indie pop rock.
Yeah, but you call everything indie pop rock.
Yeah, that's true. It's a fairly broad category. I don't know. It was definitely easy listening. It was very enjoyable to listen to, and I've got it. It's in my. I think it's something that I need to sit down and listen to, over a longer period of time, to really feel whether or not it's an album that I really like.
You know what it is? It's noise rock, but it's easy listening.
It's light.
It's easy listening noise. It's actually what they said it was going to be. So they're into that sort of psych, the kind of slightly psychedelic space and doing weird breakdowns and all that sort of stuff. But the harmonies and the melodies are very pleasant and approachable. So they've taken a genre that can be really obtuse and they've approached it in a really approachable kind of way.
It's a very Gizzard thing to do, isn't it?
It is. It's like Gizzard's dads. it's really quite chill. I have to say, I listened to it. That was actually the last thing I listened to before we started the sports podcast about an hour ago. An hour and 15 minutes ago. It's a genuinely pleasant musical experience. It's one of those albums whereby you're not going to pick a bunch of superstar crash hits off it, which is kind of something that works when we pick tracks for our mixtape. Often we listen to albums and in the back of your mind you're going, now which song is going to go on the mixtape, which is totally the wrong attitude to have when you listen to an album, because the point of the album is, what's the album like end to end, you know, 40 minutes, whatever the thing is. But it's the sort of album that doesn't have a lot of tracks that sort of jump out, but the whole thing was just gives such a lovely vibe. It's Marbo. It's the vibe.
It definitely had a vibe. Like, this got a couple of runs this week, you know, background music while I was working. And that's why I don't think... Nothing jumped out at me enough to make me go back and stop. Because I do that when I listen on that background thing. I'm waiting for something to jump out at me and I go back and restart that track and listen to it a little bit more closely.
But that's picking singles out of an album, which is kind of not the point.
But that's That's what I'm saying. Like when I'm trying to find the song that I think should be the single, that's what I do. I sort of background it and wait for that moment where it draws me out of whatever I'm doing.
So what did?
Nothing. It was just pleasant, and I'd start it again, and it was just pleasant to listen to. But there was nothing that jumped out at me that made it. Does that make the album not that great, or does it make it a better album? I'm not that, and that's why I put it into my playlist that I've got for song, you know, albums for this year that I want to go back to and listen to for the shortlist, because I'm not sure whether that's a good album or whether there's just not any song strong enough to jump out at you. I can't decide.
Yeah, I like Something Is Wrong in My Brain. Something Has Gone Wrong in My Brain. I can't remember what the exact title is, but it's the first track on the album and the last track on the album, right? I actually really enjoy. And Succubus was picked, ironically, by the in that spin-off thing, because they were looking for, you know, they were doing like a Ringer / AV Club style tracks you should be listening to right now, and they picked Succubus out off this... Teeth album.
Mm.
I should point out this band is not what it says on Spotify under about, because Spotify has a thing whereby if you get multiple artists with the same name, they just group all of the recordings under it. So this has been grouped alongside albums from a Manila grunge band from the Philippines, which is not what we're listening to today. So it's I don't know when Filipino Music Month is, but that's not what we picked.
No. Well, I clicked on Soundgarden today, and they said bands like this even, and I was like,
even?
I think you guys need to check your algorithm.
But the thing is that even. I think we had this discussion when we did that thing. There was like an album that was plugged, that was stuck in with the Even tracks. That was from another band called Even that had a completely different sound to Even from Melbourne, who were you know, kind of a Beatles Bowie influenced act.
Mm. Okay.
That
might be the case then. All right, shall we get on to the Gurge?
We should.
Shall we talk about Unit first before
So you pick Unit. I mean, Unit is 20 this year. I think we said Unit was 20 last week. It's not quite. I mean, the Unit wasn't released until November 1997, which was only 18 months after the release of Two Playing, it should be pointed out. Mm. And they'd gone on a bloody American tour and a whole bunch of other stuff. They recorded Unit in 6 weeks in an abandoned warehouse in Brisbane, because that's a very regurgitated thing to sort of do, I think.
It's a very Brisbane music thing to
do, really.
Well,
the thing about regurgitator is, I mean, we're similar age to these dudes, and they're a little bit older than us because their bands were being played on Triple J when we were paying attention. But I felt like I grew up with bands like Regurgitator and Spiderbait and You're My and that sort of stuff, but particularly Regurgitator, because when I first started listening to Triple J, the songs off their first couple of EPs were getting played on Triple J. And it was a big thing that their new album was going to come out soon. Their new album was going to come out soon. And their new album in question would have been Two Playing. So it's been really interesting to watch the evolution of Regurgitator, because they've evolved partly because of the creative tension between Kwan and Ben, but primarily because of Kwan, because he's a fucking interesting dude. I've always been drawn to Kwan as a dude I like to hear from and a dude I'm really interested in. And his songs, he was writing songs about being the fucking the arch dork in the party context, the dude who wasn't drinking and smoking and trying to rip it up and the social. I mean, Social Disaster is one of the songs I do play. So I felt like a connection with Kwan, even though he's a Vietnamese Brisbane dude, and I'm not.
Not.
But it's been interesting to watch the evolution of Regurgitator in terms of how they try and do their art, because they do see it as an art, and they always try to shake it up and change the context to the extreme extent of recording an album in a bubble in Federation Square live on Channel V for 2 weeks. Unit.
Yeah, so this was just one of those albums that hit our share house like, you know, a ton of bricks. Because it's irreverent, it's got lots of swears in it. Some of the subject matter is a little bit naughty. But I just think it's a really interesting put-together album. The fact that they marry some real pop-type genres with sort of techno music or hip-hop music, and then, you know, still throw in the big chunky guitars, and it just all seamlessly works. Like, it doesn't feel like they're just trying to shoehorn bits in. The whole thing seems to work as a whole. They get a little bit of that Radiohead, let's do a really fucking experimental song, almost like pissing in a bottle and calling it art, sort of the musical version of that.
Literally, like by writing a song about how you're embarrassed to piss at the urinal because you can't generate as much pressure as everyone else.
Yeah, like, but just the, you know, they're the sort of songs when you hear them the first time, it's like really funny. But 20 years later, when you've had, you know, when you've listened to the album so many times, it's just skip, you know, that the songs aren't that flash as songs. You know, they're probably fine as pieces of art, but not that listenable.
What would you throw in there as an example?
There's two songs.
There's a safe double skip in the middle of the album, isn't there?
Yeah, is it?
Unit.
I Piss Alone and Unit?
Yeah, I Piss Alone and Unit. Unit is are skippable. I Piss Alone is kind of a mutant Buzzcocks punk song, but the way they treated it in production, they went a bit over the top, and it's basically unlistenable.
Yeah, that's what I feel.
That's kind of the problem. Yeah.
And Unit's not much better.
And Unit's just, feel the unit, touch the unit. And 1, 2, 3, 4 is not much better. It's interesting that the weakest songs on the album are the three-chord punk rocker sort of tracks, because that was how they got to be in a position to be successful in the first place. And that's also what they lent on a lot after they stopped doing the 80s synth rock stuff as much.
But, you know, the video game influenced song is just pure fucking genius. Like, could totally be on a movie soundtrack of, you know, like, I could just see Edgar Wright doing a retro influenced, you know, 80s video game movie with that as sort of the key big song. I just think they marry so many different elements in this and weld them all together, which just doesn't, like, if you sort of,
it's just remarkable for two, basically it's two dudes writing the songs. And if you look at the songwriting of Unit, it's Quan, 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 Ben, 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 Quan, Ben, Quan, Ben. They've got even number, I mean, the big hits on Unit, Everyday Formula, the song formerly known as, which is just the best fucking pop song. It is the best rip-off of Prince until Bruno Mars and Mark Ronson did theirs, which is also a pretty good rip off of Prince. But it's just such, when I was listening, there's a, I'll shout this out nice and early, folks. Regurgitated a tour in 2012 where they did Unit and, they did two playing in Unit live. And there's a live album on Spotify called Cheap Imitations, which doesn't have both albums in their entirety, but it has most of Tupling and most of Unit and some other bits and pieces.
We'll get to that later.
And but I was fucking lurching around the fucking kitchen, dancing like a white man.
Yeah, I'll be listening to that tomorrow.
No, it's pretty good. And it reminded you that even when you strip away a lot of the production, because obviously you can't do a lot of production, when they just guitar, bass, synthesizer, and because this is current, Gredstone in those days actually had a permanent keyboardist, but even to strip out a lot of the production, the songs are incredibly solid, and they respond. They are very good live.
I saw this album being toured, and it was fucking awesome live. Really, really good. Like, yeah, you would think that a song with this much pop aesthetic would suck live, you know, would be really hard to replicate and would be hard to have the energy. But they brought that sort of pop on-stage presence to it. You know, they made like the irony that they had in the actual sound translated to the way they performed it. That's the way I felt watching it anyway. Like Polyester Girl you remember that song, I'm a Barbie Girl in a Barbie World? Like, it's a piss take of that style of cheap pop song that was kicking around the
But that's Kwan. That's, I mean, that's absolutely Kwan, is that he had this subversive pop songs were his, I'm talking like he's dead. He's not dead. He just lives in Hong Kong and doesn't record that much anymore. Subversive pop songs were his bread and butter from the start. Right through, I sucked a lot of cock to get where I am, which is we're getting to two playing again, but one of the greatest pop songs ever written, but just happens to have the filthiest fucking chorus that you have no chance of being able to sing along with in any kind of mixed company.
Well,
take a look at me. Tell me, what do you see? I got all I want.
It's a little bit hard to do my traditional run through in the car or at work with this either of these albums.
Oh, really? We should focus on Unit, because two of the best songs live were not singles, and that is World of Sleaze, because of that fantastic sing-along Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band fucking chorus of dicks and cunts and sluts and butts, pimps and hoes, yeah, plenty of those. It is incredible, soaring, climbing fucking Beatles-esque chorus.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, it's like
you have to force yourself not to sing along to.
It's like the best Britpop song. It's like better than anything Blur or Oasis ever did in that style of music, but completely and utterly unplayable.
Unsingable. Unanythingable.
On most radio.
Exactly. And then I know that you've bagged me out previously for saying that Kwan's hip-hop songs are good. Kwan's hip-hop songs are good, and I Will Lick Your Asshole is an amazing flow to it.
They're not hip-hop songs, though.
What would you call it when you've got beats and you've got a guy rapping? What do you call that, Izzo?
Stop
putting up fences with your imaginary little genre. That's hip-hop. It doesn't matter that it's an Asian dude doing it, you fucking racist. That killed a moment.
We'll agree to disagree. I think World of Sleaze is my favourite song on this album. I just think it's so well put together.
It's very well engineered, and World of Sleaze and what's the last song called?
Just another beautiful story.
That is so fucking. Those two songs are completely Beatles. They aren't in that kind of 80s synth pop stuff. That is in a completely different space. And he's obviously aping Beatles fucking cues with the way he structured certain bits. He's cueing off things, but it was really quite good.
I have to say all the my parents, Vanessa's parents, and most of the people at Vanessa's 21st of that age were on the dance floor when someone dropped I Will Lick Your Asshole, which was one of the funnier things that I've
seen. I assume everyone sung along, because literally the live set, whenever I've been at a Gurge's head of it, a Gurge gig, and they've dropped that, they just turn the mic over. It's like, I will lick your asshole. But the rhymes in that are so good. The way he structures it, and it is the complete opposite of every fucking braggadocio, cock-swinging rap thing, because he's singing about the fact that he's an incompetent fucking loser who hates public spaces and can't go out. Like, I never like it loud and dark places scare me. I dig the rock and roll as much as Peter, Paul and Mary, which is such a good line. And the one about, you know, I've got the special effects like the BBC man. That's kind of the reason I warmed to Kwan as a teenager, was because he was queuing off nerdy shit that only nerdy shits would know.
Well, okay, this is the other thing that didn't really strike me until I listened to this again, because I never really put two and two together. But Funkles are the regurgitator of hip-hop. There's that same nerdy...
Same regurgitator of hip-hop.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
Did you listen to Tupac?
I did listen to Tupac.
Which is mostly hip-hop tracks?
No.
Might not be hip-hop you like, but it's mostly hip-hop tracks. It's Cypress Hill, and it's a bit of Rage Against the Machine. It's pretty transparent if you're paying attention.
It's got some... Yeah, okay. I know what you're saying, but I just don't think it is. I don't think it comes from the place that makes it hip-hop. It's got elements of hip-hop.
Adelaide?
Yes. Adelaide. No, I just... Okay, let's move past that. You explain to me why you think 2Playing's better than Unit, if you still think that.
No, I don't believe 2Playing's better than Unit. That was purely a nostalgic point of view. But the 2Playing is much more of a... Much more hip-hop themed than I recalled. There's a lot more... I mean, G7 Dig Boogie and Music is Sport. There's a lot of tracks that kind of sit... Pop Porn, which is... Someone described as being so... I went so overboard in trying to parody the misogyny of gangster rap that they actually completely out-misogynied any gangster rap track that had ever been recorded, which is probably actually quite true. Because it's brutal in its imagery, shall we say. It's a little bit over the top. So we'll start at the beginning with Regurgitated. They had those EPs that came out in the early 90s. Really, those EPs were really singles. They were basically track one, Blubber Boy, Couldn't Do It. The problem was that when they released 2Playing, they put remixes of those tracks onto 2Playing. So you ended up with crappy versions of those great singles than the versions that should have been out there. So I think that's a bad mark for 2Playing.
They've got really good songs on 2Playing, right? And they've got crappy songs like Unit does. But I think it's the middle of the road songs that make 2Playing not as good as Unit.
Yep.
I thought they were filler. There was more filler in because the crappy songs.
I don't
on
think they ever have filler with Regurgitator. I think they just have failed experiments.
Yeah, I was going to say. Well, I find the crappy songs on Gurge albums are shit that they've reached for, and it's not what I want to hear. You know, there's probably some people like that really like those songs.
Hip hop that wasn't done by people from Adelaide.
I'm not the person to explain it to you. It's not hip hop, but anyway, what did you listen to Art at all?
Look, I did, and just to wrap up on 2Playing. So I think I went into this thinking 2Playing was going to be my classic album, and I listened to it, and I very quickly realised that it's not a classic album. It has my favourite Regurgitated tracks on it. It has Blubber Boy. If immediately it's not the original version, the EP version. It has Sucked a Lot of Cock, which is the greatest pop song ever written. It has Kung Fu Sing, which, if anyone follows me on Instagram, knows. I actually found the Kung Fu Sing in New World, in Center City, Dunedin, today, just so I could take a photo of it and say, it's the king. Because the Kung Fu Sing is a holy scripture. I heard the word, I got the picture. Ancient wisdom in a crunchy treat. Place where the faith and the flavor meet. I fucking love that song. That's such a good song. But that thing is that because that's like 95, that's, you know, I'm leaving high school, I'm going to uni, it's just that, it's pure nostalgia that makes that so important to me. And there's no way you can peel out the subjectiveness and be completely objective about it. There's just no way you can do that. So, I mean, I'll certainly put my hand up and say 2Playing's not as good an album as Unit. It's probably not as good an album as Art. It's not as good an album as Mishmash. But I have a great affection for it. Mm. Art is kind of Unit B. I listened to it again and went, oh, this is a better album than I remembered. But it kind of just feels like they
It doesn't have the high points, I think, is the problem.
Yeah, and the album after it, which was Eduardo and Rodriguez's Wage War and T-Rex, which was sort of, they said, well, you know, there's going to be more hip-hop on this. Well, the supposition is that this is the hip-hop album. It's got all my hip-hop. It doesn't really. It's got just as many Ben Eli fucking three-chord thrashes as anything else.
Mm. Yeah.
I think the problem with art and well, let's call it Ed and Rod, those two albums that happened before the Band of the Bubble, was they lacked a focus. Unit had a very clear focus. It had a purpose, an aim, an objective. Art and Ed and Rod just kind of felt like continuations. It was like, well, we've got a contract to fill with Warner Music. We need to turn out albums. We're going to all put in the songs that we would have been writing, and they're just variations on stuff we've written before. And I think that's kind of why they gravitated towards this Band of the Bubble concept, was because
it gave them a focus of what they should do.
I watched the Band of the Bubble DVD during the week. And Kwan actually talks about it, saying we needed this shock, we needed this boot up the ass. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but it felt that their creative progress had stagnated, and they needed the challenge of doing it in a public space and having this antagonist in the shape of Jabba from Channel V, who was in there to make television, not in there to make a video, an album, and that required a different pattern of behaviours. Unfortunately, to his personal detriment, because he. It really affected him quite badly, and it was actually quite, it was really quite unpleasant watching somebody in clear mental health distress, unable to get out of the circumstance. I reckon if you ran that thing again today,
yeah, it'd get,
or they'd get him out of there a lot quicker, and they'd be a lot more, be a lot less gung ho about it. They're just like, oh no, you'll be right, you'll sort it out. The other thing is, it was quite odd watching it because at the time Ben Eli was with Yumi Steins. They were partnered up and breeding, and she was on Channel V and have broken up, and so everyone was with was broken up, and there was sort of, you know, Paul Hester came along and appeared at Sir Shot, he's gone, and Darren from Magic Dirt turned up and he's gone. It was kind of a sad time capsule in a lot of ways.
Of Australian music,
of you know, people who are no longer with us, but I actually have to say that the problem with the Band in the Bubble thing is that I have a massive affection for Mishmash as a result, because it came from that process, because I watched all that stuff in 2004, and having watched it again, it's really hard to end up to come out of that process without a great affection for the band. And a great interest in the way they go about their business and the way they go through their creative process. So although Mishmash is a flawed album, it's really interesting from the perspective of the context in which it was made, the parts in which it was hewn from. There are probably more guitar-based drum songs on that album than a lot of other regurgitator albums. But that's because they're easier to bring in. If you've got a pack, 10 pairs of undies, and some demos in your head to record an album in 21 days in a fucking glass box in Variation Square, they're going to be those sorts of albums, those sorts of songs that don't require a lot of production.
Well, I remember, like, when I was going through that classic album phase and really interested in production, and Triple J ran a series, which I wish they put out on podcast, called the Producers, I think. And... it's funny, bands that become more successful, so they have more time and better gear and
Magoo.
There's not something pushing them. And then you get bands that go, right, let's go and hire a house for 2 weeks and we're going to write and record a whole fucking album in 2 weeks. And, like, artificially try to recreate that pressure that having no money puts on people.
Well, that's the regurgitator model, because they recorded two playing in some fucking farm in Thailand. Mm. Unit was in an abandoned warehouse.
Warehouse with Magoo, I think.
Yo, Magoo did all their early albums. Mm. So Magoo was in the Band of the Bubble, which is interesting because the album before, Eduardo and Rodriguez, they hadn't had Magoo in. And I reckon it probably suffered as a result. But, yeah, two playing was in Thailand. Unit was in Brisbane. Art was in Byron Bay. Eduardo Rodriguez was somewhere or other, but they didn't have your man. And then they kind of went, right, we need to put some external evolutionary pressure on this process. And that is really interesting to me because I'm interested in the way creative processes are forced into being, whether they just sort of ping into your mind out of thin air, or whether you actually have to put some pressure on them, and how people come up with the cool ideas they have. And that's why, I mean, as I said, I watched it during the week, and it was really interesting to watch both the huge circus that was going on around the band, but also the minutiae of the creative process. And Magoo is a very patient producer. He's a very
coax the best
out of
people. Consultative
sort of producer. He's exactly right. He's a dude you would want on that kind of job.
What's his name from Garbage has always struck me like that as a producer.
Vig.
Vig, yeah. Because
I thought Vig had a template and he wanted you to fit to it.
I always thought he was like, you know, I'm just going to bring it, partially because he's been in a band and been through the process of being on the other side so much. But maybe that's just the feeling I got from interviews and stuff. I always wonder about that Hunters, you know, I've talked before about Hunters having awesome live recordings and terrible, terrible studio recordings, whether a couple of the guys in the band were just in love with production, post-production.
Just in love with that sound, that kind of nasty, clangy fucking snare. And
well, just like that when they did studio stuff, the mix was just so different to their live stuff. Like all the horns and everything were pulled right out of the mix, it just sounded nothing like their live stuff.
Yeah, but live you can't fuck around with it much. You know,
you end up with a lot more bottom end
live. That's just a given.
And a band live, you know, you have to. It's a little bit like a football team. You got to keep everyone happy. You got to give, or a basketball team. You got to give your big guy some touches. You can't just fucking ignore him.
Got to give your horn some minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I think what I learned out of this process was that what unified the best Gurge albums was that strong concept, prior concept, and a sense of purpose.
Mm.
And that's exactly what Unit has. It clearly has. They knew what they wanted to do. They knew what they wanted to do was a total, because Two Playing is such a punk and hip hop heavy album in terms of the influences that drive the sound. And they, as they evolved the sound for Unit, they realized we actually want to do a lot more synthesizer stuff. We want to do a lot more 80s pop. And I feel like Kwan was going that direction because of the collaboration with Janet and Happy Land and all that sort of stuff. I mean, Everyday Formula is a song that could have gone on the Happy Land album very easily, not just because Janet guests on it, but it's exactly the kind of upbeat, frenetic, synthy pop song that Happy Land was entirely about.
I've always thought Kwan was a little bit of our Australia's Mike Patton. You know, he just had so many different ideas and ways that he could have gone.
Yep.
You know, he could do the Happy Land stuff. He could do, you know, big chunky riffs. He could pretty much do whatever struck him at the time.
Drinking of his own piss, though. And I feel like Kwan, and from this is what I get from watching the Band of the Bubble stuff. Driven by an insecurity about his own, like he's never happy with what he'd done, and never actually believed in it. And you pick apart the lyrics, and particularly his earlier stuff, and even his later stuff. A lack of self-belief and a feeling of being the other and a feeling of being, you know, a public school educated Vietnamese Australian kid when, you know, he wasn't cool enough. Like, he's talked previously about the fact that the Powderfinger guys were all private school guys and they bossed the Brisbane the music scene at the time. And they always felt like outsiders and weirdos and cunts because they were outsiders and weirdos and cunts. But I think that's where his art comes from. I think without all that, it wouldn't actually, without that insecurity and without that, you know, you wouldn't get songs like...
You wouldn't get the edge to it.
You wouldn't get I Would Lick Your Asshole because that song's entirely about how shit he is. and using fantastic metaphors like I'm tough under pressure, just like Sarah Jane Smith. It's like, no.
No, it's held up really well, is what I felt.
It's a really good album, and I would recommend you go and listen to that fucking live.
Yeah,
it's
if you haven't listened to Unit, what the fuck are you doing? Stop this and go listen to
the live set. It's good. I wanted to pull out, which was I was on the campus of the university I went to in 1996, and I saw posters up saying, you know, O-Week, Regurgitator. I thought, oh, cool. I like Regurgitator. They're cool because, of course, I'd been hanging out for their Regurgitator album to come out. Turned out it was an actual Regurgitator, like someone who, like, swallowed coins. Because he's like the dude who turned... Because there was a guy who used to go on the footy show. He, like, swallowed coins and towels and shit. And bring them back up again. So disappointed.
Like, if you got caught on that, there must have been at least a couple of hundred other people that turned up then turned around and walked out straight away.
I wouldn't have ever gone to a Regurgitator concert because I was such a fucking arch dork in first year. I mean, I didn't even fucking drink. And literally that line from... Oh, lick your asshole, you know. I never like it loud and dark places scare me. I dig the rock and roll as much as Peter, Paul and Mary. That was me. I would never go out to a live gig and you know, I just wasn't comfortable around that sort of people. That's why Social Disaster of Two Planks spoke to me, because I didn't drink and I hated going out because I hated the smell of cigarette smoke and people being fucking belligerent cockheads and the music being too loud and all that sort of stuff.
Which is Brisbane music. But look, the funny thing is...
The world has changed. Well, basically, I started drinking and that problem went away.
The funny thing is, I know I've seen these guys, I don't know, 10, 11 times live. I know I have. I've definitely seen them at a market day and so. But their set at Festival Hall, one of the last shows at Festival Hall, just has obliterated every other memory of them live out of my brain. I can only remember because it was one of the most perfect live gigs I ever went to.
So that must have been...
It was the Unit tour. It was the tour for Unit.
No, well, that wasn't Festival Hall closing tour.
No, it wasn't. It was close to the end, though. There wasn't...
No, Festival Hall kept going until like the...
The last year, later, 18 months.
But no.
Festival
Hall closed in like 2003, and Unit was not 2003. Because I was thinking if they were touring Festival Hall in their last days, it would have been like fucking Eduardo, Ed and Rod, or it would have been Mishmash or something. I don't know what they were touring.
There was something else I went to at Festival Hall, but that Festival Hall gig.
I went to Fat Pizza at Festival Hall. I think that was the last gig. I literally think that was certainly
the second last gig was
going to see the Fat Pizza live show.
Wow, what a way to go out! All right, shall we talk some new tunes?
We can talk new tunes. What albums have you picked this week?
I've got a few this
week.
What
old albums? What old bands making a comeback have you picked this week?
Well, how old are Dappled Cities? Dappled Cities would have to be reasonably old, I would imagine, because they used to be called Dappled Cities Fly. And maybe not. I'm pretty sure that this is a 2004 was their first album. So the first incarnation of this band played the Alley, but I doubt this is the same sort of version of that band. So Dappled Cities, their new album is Five Strokes in a Row.
So this is five, like maybe? This is like the Jefferson Starship version of Jefferson Airplane.
Yes.
For really old people.
Yeah, it is an Australian quintet known as Dappled Cities Flies on their first album. So
what made them think that the more complicated name was the one to go with?
Don't know at all.
What makes anybody name any band? My friends or Rom were named after someone's rat.
And I'm going to go Kasabian because I like a Kasabian single.
That was on my shortlist. I will tell you that much.
Good enough for me to to give an album a go.
So the album, I think, on Spotify has a live set as a B-side.
Oh, right. So For Crying Out Loud is the name of the album.
If it's the new album, yeah. It has like a live show. Because for a couple of years there, the Premier League were using Fire as their match day theme. And Fire is a fucking banger. It's a really good song.
Yeah, they can write some really fucking good songs. Yeah. Like really, really
they
good
can
songs.
Write a fucking banger or two.
I don't know whether they can write an album, though. Yeah. That's what I'm interested to find out.
Yeah, no, they've never been accused of that before, I think. You kind of think of them in the melee of British bands of that vintage, Muses and Company, but it's a bit hard to get a grasp on exactly who they are and who they were and what their sound is and that sort of stuff. So, Kasabian, comfortable with that. Dappled Cities, flying or otherwise. We'll have to see if they're on Spotify.
It's poppy. It'll be poppy from what I remember seeing them live. They were very poppy, so... we'll give it a go. What's going to be your classic this week, Doc?
Because of DJ, after DJ format abdominal thing, I was all set to go down a late 80s golden era of hip hop hole. So I had it all lined up, and then Chris Cornell had fucking die. Super Unknown. Really, if you're saying what's the quintessential Chris Cornell, at least starting point for a conversation, it's Soundgarden Super Unknown. There's interesting stuff in the back catalogue earlier than that with your Bad Motor Fingers and so forth. There's interesting stuff in the Audio Slave space, but I reckon for starters, we'll just talk Soundgarden and see where we go. Because he was the biggest voice in alternative rock for decade. Bracket S, because he was plural decades. There's never been pipes like that in the space in alternative rock.
I'm sure we'll discuss this album as an album, but we'll probably also, like, I know I've already gone down a red hot with some of his other stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, I'd be inclined, I wouldn't mind setting aside the Audioslave stuff for a separate conversation, because I suspect there's a classic album in there that we can that we can turn into a conversation. But basically, if you stick his voice in front of stuff, it works. That's kind of how shit works.
Yep. All right, Doc. That's a hole I'm quite happy to fall down to for at least a week.
I was delaying it because literally I was down the regurgitator hole when he passed. The Thursday night, which is yesterday night as we record it now, and I was like, I've got this nostalgia hole to fucking work on. I can't go down that one, but anyway, what it is, I'm like, all right, Quan, you go and stand over there. I'm going to listen to this, and found there's a fantastic rarities compilation that's just old B-sides and weird stuff and a shitload of really cool covers, like everything from Spinal Tap to fucking just the Rolling Stones, just stuff that you'd have never imagined that Soundgarden would have ever have covered. They've just got cover versions.
A little bit like, in a very different way, but a little bit, if you've got a very amazing voice like he does or Patton does or even Hutchins from INXS, you know, who had a very distinctive voice, you can pretty much do whatever you fucking want with it, can't you?
Well, I don't know, it's not so much about INXS, but I know Faith No More loved a cover.
I started a joke,
Easy. They did War Pigs, of course. They did a fucking amazing version of War Pigs. And there's a great version of Into the Void in terms of Black Sabbath covers on that. It has a really weird name that I can't remember, but it came out of it in 2014, this kind of rarities compilation. We'll link it when we remember to link it. I'll get the show notes going to sort that out.
You do that. All right, Doc, I'll catch you on the flip side.
Sure. I like your old pod better than your new pod. Actually, I like their old remix better than their new remix. That's one of the things. One of the songs of that album I don't like is the shit version of I Like Your Old Stuff, because I like the remix of it better. Which, ironically, I like the new version of the old stuff better than the old version of the new stuff. We're going to have to keep this in. Consider yourself stung.